Hello everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. This will be the last recorded lecture, though we do have one more lecture next week, the final Simon slideshow, where we get to review all of our photos and give praise to all of the terrific photographs that you've taken throughout the semester. And I certainly hope that all of you will be present for that, as it will be quite a bit of fun. Okay, so one of the biggest pieces of news that I have for you is that I've posted almost all of your themes and banners on the course website. So if you haven't seen it yet, head on over to cse7.org/themes, and you will be able to see all of them. So the first few are mine and the staff's, but pretty soon you get to see all of the themes that that you have submitted. And strangely enough, I do actually have to take a moment to chastise most of you, because literally half of the submissions had one or more problems with them, and I had to do a sort of not just one but several mass emailings late last night, early this morning, trying to get people to resize the images. And I'll be interested to hear what went wrong, because the biggest problem was this resizing of the image, and almost everybody had the same problem where they had the right aspect ratio, but the size of the image was like 1,000 pixels by 250, it was like 280 something like that, which was close, but not really correct. And so I'll be interested to hear. I suspect there's some sort of Photoshop silliness that happened, but if any of you can provide any insights so that we can provide this as sort of a watch out step for future semesters, we will be much appreciated. And of course, this being a software lecture, we will be seeing Photoshop. So if you see the tool that you used or something that went wrong and you want to point it out, then please do feel free to do so. But anyway, you should take a look at all these themes. I think all of the themes are really wonderful, really amazing themes, and I think it'll be really cool for you to see your photo and your color scheme up on the course website. And just sort of as a very small little thing that that you might find pretty neat is that when your image is being displayed, whether it be on your screen or on somebody else's screen because they just happen upon the course website, notice that we actually give credit to you at the very bottom. We say the header photo is copyright 2009 by whatever your author title was. So I'll zoom in a little bit here. So all of this information that I had you submit to us, like your author and description and all of these things, it's not just useless and silly. It actually does serve a useful purpose. And so congratulations on all of these wonderful submissions, and I hope that you'll take a moment to look through them. Okay, so before we dive into the software aspect of this lecture, I do want to mention something. So over the weekend, I was grading a few of the assignment threes. Oh, and by the way, we should be caught up completely with all of the grading for assignment 1 through 3, not 4 yet. That'll be very, very soon. If you have not received feedback for assignments 1 through 3 and you submitted it to us, please send us an email and let us know. Something might have gotten mixed up or something might have happened, because we should all be caught up with that. But while grading the assignment threes, of course, it's very difficult to just sit down and do this one right after the other, so I had to procrastinate for a bit. And in my procrastination, I came across this link that I found that I'm going to show you shortly, but I think ties in pretty well to what I was telling you before, where I was saying that these cameras, especially SLRs, maybe not necessarily the compact cameras, but SLRs in particular, are pretty tough little critters, and they can really withstand quite a bit. And so just to show you, this is a relatively new Canon 7D that a professional photographer took down to Antarctica, along with, I mean, a lot of equipment. As you can see, this is a 300mm lens. That costs quite a bit of money. Also brought down some of the Canon flagship models and some other models as well. And he was not kind to the equipment. Well, more specifically, it's the weather was not kind to him, and he cared more about his own health than that of his cameras, and rightfully so, perhaps. But what's interesting, I think, is if you look at this, I mean, pretty much every button and everything is sort of frozen over, like the shutter button. He claims that it continued to work, but I don't see how. It seems to be that there's this layer of ice over the shutter button. And again, this is not to demonstrate or not to be an advertisement for one particular model or another, But just to show you that SLRs can be pretty handy, and I know that many of you, myself included, especially at first, baby our equipment, but this is what it's designed to do. It's designed to take photos, and it's designed to work in or adverse conditions. And while I don't advocate that, you know, the next time it snows here, because it will again soon, I'm sure, that you go outside and, you know, start freezing your camera, I just do want to demonstrate that, you know, these things will continue to, normally they will continue to function even if we are not that kind to them. Was there a question?
Only the very top line ones have the weather.
Well, that's correct. So it is important to note that the top of the line models have full weather sealing, but this model in particular only has minimal weather sealing. Like, it's not even the top of the line what Canon considers fully weather sealed, and it still continued to work. In fact, there's a lot of controversy on, you know, on the discussion boards about people saying, oh, the Canon 5D and the 7D don't have that great weather sealing, but experience from the field seems to indicate otherwise. And there are a few other interesting photos, like this was a photo that was taken with that particular combination. So you can see the sort of adverse conditions that this camera was in. And after the ice melted, the camera was completely covered in water and salt water even, because he was taking photos along a particular cape. I think it was Cape George or something like that around that particular area. Now, this photo, I think, is kind of neat because not only is the camera sealed, but so is the tripod. Right? Okay, bad pun. But that's a particularly fun capture, I think, where a seal is apparently chomping on a tripod, and very real world conditions for this. So, of course, especially if you have entry level models or even compact cameras, you should take good care of them. But as you I'm not demonstrating this to advocate any sort of abuse or anything like that, but just to show you that sometimes we might be a little bit too careful with this. And in fact, occasionally I've gone sort of off the other end, and I remember putting my tripod in this running stream because I wanted to capture the running water and get the camera very, very close to it to have this sort of dramatic effect. And the camera was okay, the tripod was okay, but I had a remote shutter, and because I was perched precariously atop some stones so that I myself didn't get wet, I dropped the remote into the river. And I was really concerned about it, and I was like, oh no, and then it stopped working and all this stuff. But, you know, I opened it up, and it's this, you know, if you've ever bought a Canon remote, you know that they're needlessly expensive. It's like $80 or something ridiculous. And after you open up, you realize just how silly it is that you spent that much money, because it's literally like three metal prongs. And then I took it apart, dried it out, put it back together, and it continued to function. And it's just this, you know, it's literally like a $1 worth of plastic and metal that they end up pawning off as all of this to charge all of this money. But okay, anyway, back to the actual software. So we've been dealing with Photoshop up until this point to do a lot of modifications to images and to do some masking, and a lot of some of these neat and interesting ways that we can edit photos. And certainly we will continue to be using Photoshop, because that's sort of the software that we should be able to use. But I figured that we would spend a few minutes to review some of the earlier techniques that we've talked about, in particular masking, because we have had a few questions from many of you just hoping that we can do that, and hoping that we can review some of these things and be able to talk about why they're useful and how we can actually accomplish them. So in masking, we generally have an image and we need to apply some sort of correction to it. And if you'll just give me a second, I'll be opening an image in just a second. And usually what we want to do, and it's important to realize that with masking, we can actually perform a number of calculations or a number of edits to a photo with a mask. And so I have here, one second, almost. All right, so I have here just a sample image where we might want to be able to mask a particular aspect of it. And so Masking is a way that we can, it provides a couple of advantages to us. First of all, it will allow us to selectively perform edits to an image non-destructively. So what that means is that I can perform edits to this image without having to actually modify the pixels that make up the image itself. And this can be useful if you want to revert your changes. It can be useful if you want to enhance your changes later on, or even just recreate them. You can recreate them quite easily just by altering a mask. But masking actually sort of rears its ugly head in other places as well. And one of the other major ways that we see masking is in a mode of Photoshop called Quick Mask. Now, in Photoshop, one of the things that we tend to do kind of frequently is select particular regions of an image. So like this, in this case, I've just selected using the rectangular marquee tool, just an area within this image. And I might copy this image. I might use it as a way of cropping out the regions outside of this selection, variety of things. You can really do a lot of things with this. Now, what Quick Mask allows us to do is to make more refined changes to the selection through this masking idea. So yes, you can use some of Photoshop's other tools that are available to us, such as, for example, the lasso tool, or what I think is even better than the lasso tool, the magnetic lasso tool, which, if you're not too familiar, will allow you to make selections around regions that Photoshop finds are edges. So in other words, it will try to help you find particular edges, and it will try to help you make a selection just by quickly sort of going around. And as you can see, it's already made sort of a small mistake because I was trying to select around a chair, and you can see that it sort of jumped to the other side of the chair. And this is sort of what happens with the magnetic lasso tool. It's not perfect, and yeah, you could go back and frustratingly try to get every pixel as accurate as possible. But instead, what I recommend is to use these sort of crude selection tools as sort of a first pass. So you might use the magnetic lasso tool to just get a rough outline of the selection that you want to make the first time. So in this case, I'll just try to quickly go around this particular chair. And now, for those of you that have tried to make complex selections with a mouse, you probably know how frustrating it can be because you might not have the dexterity, especially on a laptop trackpad or even with a desktop computer mouse, to track at the pixel level around a particular object, even if you zoom in very, very far. And you can try to have some technology, or you can have some technology that will make it a little bit easier on you, such as through one of those tablets that you can have connected to your computer, and it's literally like you have a pen connected to it. But luckily, unless you are always using Photoshop, that's not really an expense that you have to go through necessarily. So first pass, make your crude selection using one of those tools, like using the magnetic lasso tool, or of course using one of the rectangular marquees. And one of the things that you should keep in mind are the modifier keys, so-called modifier keys of Photoshop. So the Shift key, the Alt key, and on Mac, the Command key will alter the behavior of all of these tools. So just as an example, if I were to create a new marquee right now, a new selection, you'll notice that it gets rid of my old selection. And this may not be what I want. I may want to add on to my previous selection. So by holding down a modifier key, you'll notice, let's see if I can zoom in. Now, if I hold down the Shift key, a modifier key, you'll notice that it changes to a crosshair with a plus sign right next to it. That indicates to me that I can add more onto my selection by using this particular modifier. So just by adding more to the selection, it will combine the two rather than having to select each individually. You can actually try to, the Shift key. So the same key that you use to get capital letters. And then alternatively, the Alt key will do sort of the opposite. Let me zoom in a little bit. Whoops. If I hold down the Alt key, you see that now that plus sign turns to a minus. Let me try to go over a region with more contrast. You can see that minus sign, and it will now do the opposite. It'll subtract from a particular selection. Now, this is pretty useful, but I still think that despite these modifier keys, that using these tools is crude and is not the best way of getting really refined selections out of what you want. You can use some of Photoshop's other tools. Under the Select menu, for example, which is off-screen, there are some options called Feather and Modify, which will try to make the edges of your selection softer. But still, I think it's just not that accurate. It's not, you don't get to see the feather actually working. So instead, what I recommend, this is a big build-up towards advocating the use of what's called Quick Mask. Now, Quick Mask can be slightly confusing because once you get into that mode, it sort of changes the colors. It changes the appearance of the image itself. And if you don't, and if you forget to leave Quick Mask mode, you'll get some strange behavior, such as, for example, if I make another selection and then copy this, I'm actually copying a mask. I'm not copying the image itself. So you get a weird combination of white pixels or black pixels or something in between, and it's not what you would expect at all. So you should be sure to do pretty much any operation except modifying the Quick Mask. You'll want to just be in the normal mode. Okay, so how do we enter Quick Mask? Well, there's a very big button that's provided to us that allows us to enter this mode. You can click it at the very bottom of the tools menu, or the tools bar, rather, and you will be able to enter into this mode. Notice that you see some red highlight and then just some transparent highlight that indicates to us what is currently selected. What doesn't have, whatever is transparent, whatever is not highlighted in red, is what is currently selected. So you can think of it as being able to see clearly your selection. Okay? So another way, and what I think is even faster than using this, than clicking on this button, is using one of the shortcut keys. So every time you hover your mouse over one of these tools, you were told some particular key that you can hit to be able to access that tool quickly. So for example, over this path selection tool, I can just hit the letter A on my keyboard and be able to select it. So for the Quick Mask, I just hit Q. So the Q button will revert back and forth from Quick Mask. Okay, so once in Quick Mask, now I can use this as a mask to modify and make changes to my selection. And this is nice because you can use better tools, I think, to be able to modify this particular selection. So as you know, the two most common tools that we'll typically use in a mask are the brush and the eraser tool, because you will be able to basically paintbrush the mask or erase the mask, respectively. It's important also to note that you should probably keep these colors as black and white. I think, if I exit Quick Mask mode, oh yeah, so when you enter Quick Mask mode, it goes by default to black and white, but this is generally when you are using masking, you will want to use these two colors in your color selection. Now, by clicking on the brush tool near the top, you'll notice that again, we can see that we can quickly select it using the B key, B as in boy, on the keyboard. Now I can just paint particular regions that I want to either selectively mask or unmask. So as you can see, I'm now just adding more, I'm subtracting from this selection. Now, one of the other things that I want to point out, and one of the primary reasons why I think that this is a better method than using these crude selection tools, is the interface between the areas that are not masked and the areas that are masked. So if you take a look, you see that this paintbrush tool that I just used creates sort of a soft interface between the two areas. So this means that my selection will reflect that. It will actually copy an area that has a very soft edge versus one of these tools that I used previously, which has a very harsh edge where you can actually see the individual pixels that make up that selection. And generally, this is what you want if you're trying to paste a complex shape from one photograph to another. So if I were actually trying to make a selection out of this seat and I wanted to paste it into another photograph, you usually don't want a very harsh edge. Otherwise, your paste job will be very apparent. So by having a very soft edge, it makes it a little bit smoother. And you might still have other problems like the color doesn't look right from this image to whatever I pasted it on top of, and some other things, perspective changes, size errors, etc. But at least you can correct one of these problems pretty easily. And this is, for all intents and purposes, a mask. I mean, this allows us to make a selection using a mask. And you'll notice additionally that if at the very top of the window, it says that I'm in quick mask mode. So pay attention to that as well, because it will help you determine if you are in some particular mode that you may not want to be. So now that I've exited the quick mask mode, you'll notice that the selection tries to approximate what modifications I had made, though this is somewhat inaccurate because this implies that this edge here is very harsh. It's a very rigid edge, though if I were to copy this, so I'll copy it and create a new document and paste it in here, we should see that we have the difference that I was describing before. We have this area with its very soft edges, and then we have this area over here that we created with the crude selection tools that have very harsh, rigid edges. Now, if you want these harsh, rigid edges, then you don't have to use quick mask mode, though I still recommend that you do, because when you are modifying a mask, recall that you have the brush tool and all of its associated options available to you. So at the very top of your screen, and what you didn't see until now because it was off screen, is this options bar that allows you to make modifications to whatever tool it is that you have selected. Now when you're in quick mask mode, keep in mind that that's not a tool, so you don't have options for quick mask mode itself, but when you have the brush tool selected, you can change options for that brush. So in this case, you'll notice that I had a somewhat small brush size of 13 pixels, and I had a hardness of 0%. The hardness indicating just how soft the outside edges are. You can see that these are somewhat, this is a 35 pixel, very soft brush, and this is a 19 pixel, very hard brush. You see the difference is that the edges are much harsher in the hard brush. And you can vary the hardness from zero all the way to some relatively high number, 100%, or even something in between, depending on your particular application. So when you're performing a mask and you want to, especially with a quick mask, and you want to very quickly make a very refined selection in an image, just as a quick review, I recommend that you use some of these more crude tools that are available in the upper left of your toolbar, the rectangular marquee, the magnetic lasso tool, some of these other ones. Just make a rough outline of your selection, hit Q to go into quick mask mode, and modify the quick mask with the brush tool and the eraser tool to get it to be exactly the way you want. Then after you exit quick mask mode, keep in mind you have to exit it again, otherwise you won't actually have made your selection. You can copy the selection or do whatever it is you want to do with that particular thing. Now, a lot of these ideas also transfer over to some of these other masking techniques as well. Did you have a question?
I do. So the reason I haven't been using quick mask mode is I don't understand at what point it actually makes a mask. I mean, I haven't seen it make a mask yet. Is there some other key that you have to hit to say, okay, this is what I wanted to make my mask now?
So quick mask mode doesn't... The name mask doesn't necessarily imply that you are going to be creating a mask in the sense of a layer, of creating a new mask for a new layer or for an existing layer. What it does indicate is that you are modifying a selection with a mask. So in quick mask mode, what we see is a mask. This mask right here, it's basically a somewhat translucent red mask that you are able to edit using some of these tools, like the brush tool or the eraser tool, for example. So there's the concept of a mask extends to more than just what we saw in the layers palette. A mask is what it sounds like. It's something that covers a particular aspect of an image and that we can modify to achieve some goal. And in this case, the goal of the quick mask is to alter or to create a selection in the image. I'm not doing anything other than selecting a part of the image.
So, okay, I'm still not seeing the point, which, like I said, is why I haven't been using this, because I really don't see the point. If now we say wanted to change the color of just that particular selection,
so if you want,
what the school is intended to do?
Right. So that's so the modifications that we saw before, where we created an adjustment layer to adjust the contrast, to adjust the saturation of the colors, or just to perform some sort of modification to the image as a whole, or even to a portion of the image, that's a separate thing. Usually we would do this if we wanted to just make a selection of an object. And this may not be useful if you are only going to be modifying images as they are, without moving pixels from one image to another. But where this might be useful is if you want to make a composite of images. So let's say you have an object in image A. Let's say you take the time to photograph just the lens, for example, and then you have an image B of just some guy like pretending to hold a lens, for example, and you need to create a composite of those two images. You can use Quick Mask to make a refined selection of the lens in image A, for example, copy those pixels that you've selected, go into image B, paste those pixels that you've just copied, and then you'll be able to make whatever modifications from there. So it's important to note that we are still dealing with the mask, but the intention is different than from an adjustment layer or from dealing with the layers as a whole. With that said, though, we can use this as a way to create additional layers as well. Because one of the things that you don't see that's off... All right, let me change the display settings here so that you can see all of these things that I keep referring to off screen rather than me having to refer to them and not being able to show you. All right, so back here in Photoshop, if I've created a selection as I have here, what I can do from the layer menu is be able to create a new layer based on, say, the selection that I've made. So you'll notice that up here it says I can create a new layer. All right, so under layer, new layer, via copy. So this implies that whatever I have selected is going to be pasted into a new layer for me automatically. So this does extend beyond even this idea of using it for composite images where you have two or more images that you want to somehow merge. But you can also use it as a way to make sort of more complex modifications to the same image. So now you see that I have two layers. The bottom layer is the original image that I had. The top layer, layer one, is just the selection that I had made before. And now I can make any sort of modifications to this layer that I want and still retain the layer underneath. I'll show an example of why we might want to do this in a little bit. But does that address your concern?
I still don't see any advantage over just using a regular ordinary layer because that allows you to do more things, and I'm also not really seeing how this is particularly quicker, but maybe I will. So
in Photoshop, there's a million ways to do the same thing. And if you're more comfortable doing this via some other method, then by all means, feel free. I'm showing this to you not as the sort of end-all be-all of making a selection, but as one way that you will be able to do it. And also to be able to demonstrate one method of masking techniques. So the whole point of this is the overarching theme of masking, more so than just the specific Quick Mask tool, even though I do think it is useful in some situations. If you don't find it useful, then certainly you don't have to use it. I'm not trying to force this.
And I'm not going to get into a religious argument.
No, of course. No religious arguments necessary.
I was just saying that I really honestly don't.
No, it's a fair question, but it's a fair question to ask why this tool is useful. The reason I'm stumbling is because, yes, there are other ways of accomplishing the same thing. You might, again, just to reiterate, you might just find one way faster than the other or easier. So if something makes it faster, easier for you to accomplish something, then that would generally be the way, I guess, you would go. So certainly, of course, I'm not saying that you don't have to ask these sorts of questions. I certainly welcome them. Okay. Now, back on track, let's see. I was talking about, the masking techniques that we had discussed before involved a different type of mask altogether, a mask that we would apply to layers specifically. So we might have different types of layers. We might have an adjustment layer, for example, where we want to non-destructively modify all of the contrast in a particular image. So let's say that I have my lower layer selected. I can create a new adjustment layer under the layers menu. And if I wanted to change its contrast, I think I did contrast last time. So let me do something different just to show you a different tool, like curves. Create a new adjustment layer. You'll notice that in the lower right-hand corner, I haven't deleted yet that layer that I made via copy from that quick mask that I made. I'm just leaving it there temporarily. But the new one that's important is this new curves adjustment layer. And you'll notice that's chained to the adjustment. So this is the adjustment, and chained to it is a mask that allows us to modify specific regions of this image with the adjustments that we make. So let's say that I want to make this even contrastier than it is right now, so I can just do some simple curves. You'll notice that now it looks contrastier, and so I'll just hit return, and that is the image that I get. But if the end goal isn't to modify the contrast in the entire image, but instead to modify it only in certain regions, this is where the masking techniques come in handy. So you have to keep in mind to actually select the layer that you want to modify. And in this case, I want to modify the mask. I don't want to modify the original image. I want to modify the mask that applies to the adjustment layer. Once I have that selected, then I can use the brush tool again. Let's see, it's all the way over here, so let me move it to a friendlier location. Again, I will use the brush tool to be able to paint regions that I don't want to apply. It is making the change. It's just difficult to see. All right, here. That I don't want this adjustment layer to apply. Now, can you even see the change? No? All right, let me do something even more drastic. We are going to, completely invert the colors. So I just inverted the colors just to make this very obvious, the changes in the adjustment layer. This isn't typically something you would do. Yeah, I guess it is cool. But it is also, I think, painful after a little while to look at. So now you can see as I paint the mask, you can see that I am fixing the colors that I have just intentionally broken. And that is the goal of the mask. The goal of the mask is to apply to specific regions of an underlying image some change that this layer represents. So this layer represents a change in the curves, where I've actually inverted all of the colors. And there's a mask that is applied to that. So if you, the mask can vary anywhere from a value of 0, representing black, through all of the gray scales, all the way up to 255, which represents white. And everywhere the mask is white, that means that this layer is being applied, and that is what you will see being modified to the layer underneath. So all of the regions that are black means that the underside, the under layer, will show through that specific layer. So we can see, if we just go back to this original layer, we can see that all the regions that are black, we will see the original layer underneath shining through. So all the regions that are white will then have that adjustment performed on it. Now, it is sometimes useful to be able to modify the mask itself. Holding down that modifier key, Alt, that Alt key, and then clicking on the mask will allow you to not only select the mask, but also see just the mask. And this will let you fix maybe little errors that you have in your mask to be able to make sure it is absolutely perfect as you want it to be. There, perfection. Okay, now, if you recall, I was showing you some of these options that exist for the brush tool. If you're making large modifications to a mask, I generally recommend the following. So first, I think you should go with a relatively large diameter. Nothing obscene, but maybe 100 pixels is a good size to start out with. And then also start with a relatively high hardness, because then you will make very concrete changes to the mask that you will see very, very noticeably and very visibly. And then you can just make your modifications to whatever large area, just do a crude outline of the large area that you want to modify. Then let's say there's finer detail that you have to be able to modify. That is when you start decreasing the diameter and decreasing the hardness. Then you will be able to get a softer edge along the outside of this image. All right, so that's not obvious enough. I'll go all the way down to zero. Now you can see a very soft edge here as opposed to the harder edges over here. And that's all that masking does. So you can apply a mask to an adjustment layer, but you can also apply a mask to a regular layer as well that might contain normal pixels. So if you recall, before I had pasted just a particular region of this image on top of itself. So if I show both of these layers, it looks like the original image, but there is a layer on top that has a subset of pixels of the bottommost image. Okay? So here you can see the composite of the two. Here is just the top layer. Now you can apply this layer, and this will be used, let's say I do make changes to this as a whole, and I'm going to get rid of, let's see. Oops, don't want to save it. Not this monstrosity. Okay, so now let's say that I have performed some sort of adjustment to this layer. Now, one of the things that we can do if we want to preserve some of the original pixels, in addition to using a mask, is that we can also paste additional pixels on top and be able to make modifications to this set of pixels as well. So we can apply yet another mask. So keep in mind that the mask of the adjustment layer below is left completely white, which means that all of the pixels in this image are being modified. So let's say that I paste in some pixels from another image, or I just want to do something kind of cool with the pixels from this image. I can move them around or do something like that. So what would perhaps be a better example than my very crude example here would have been if I had selectively copied only the plush cat, for example, created a new layer from him, and I wanted to replicate him in the adjacent chairs as well. So then I could make whatever modifications to the bottommost image through the adjustment layer. Then in the topmost layer, I would have my virtual cats that I would be able to move and put over each of these, and then I could just use masking to be able to modify what pixels are visible. So under the layer menu, I can select a layer mask. You'll notice that there's two types, the reveal all and the hide all. Reveal all means that all of the pixels in the current layer will be shown. A hide all means that none of the pixels will be shown. And this is just by default. You can switch between the two masks very easily just by inverting it. And I'll demonstrate that now. So right now, because we have a reveal all of the pixels in the mask are white. But if I invert and make them all black, this means that none of the pixels would be appearing. And that is what we see. But by inverting this and I can have a reveal all mask, you will see all of these pixels, and now I can, without having to delete specific pixels within this layer, I can actually selectively paint regions that I want to disappear. So what I'm doing right now is not an erase, but I'm in fact using a brush tool to paint black over the regions in the mask that I want to disappear. Okay, so the mask technology is the same across all of these techniques. Whether we apply it to a layer that contains pixels, whether we apply it to an adjustment layer or whether we're dealing with the quick mask mode, it all is the same sort of thing. We have a mask that tells us that something is going to be shown or selected, and then something else is not going to be, and it allows us to define very carefully what those areas are. Yes? Okay, so if you want to see just the cat and you want to essentially remove him from the photo. So let's say this cat is an angry ex-boyfriend that you want to remove from your life. We could use masking techniques, but there's a lot of, again, it's Photoshop, there's a million ways we could accomplish this same thing. There's two major ways I think that you would probably accomplish this. There's probably others as well, but the two major ways that I'm aware of is using a tool that's specifically for this purpose called a clone stamp tool. So you'll notice that underneath the brush, I have this tool called clone stamp. Oops. All right, so can you see it here? I don't want it to cover the tool, but you can see it. It looks like literally like a stamp. Now, when we remove a person or an object from a photograph, it's a good idea to make sure that that person has is in front of a fairly patterned background. So in this case, it might work pretty well because the texture here is fairly random. It's fairly reproducible. The only problem that I can foresee is that the brightness of the chair back somewhat changes. So that might be a problem for us as we start dealing with this. But if you have like a lot of grass, for example, a lot of blue sky, then this is something that will work out fairly effectively. Now, the clone stamp tool, as I said, is one way of doing this. Another way is if we have, we can literally copy pixels from a neighboring region that would have the same texture. We can paste it over it and perform modifications to that pasted layer using masking or by using some different layer modes that exist over the layers themselves to get it to try to match and look as good as possible. So just very quickly, I'll quickly demo both just so you can get a general idea of how we would do both. But realize that getting it sort of right takes maybe a couple of minutes, but doing a perfect job will take you a long, long time. So there's a lot of refinements that can be done. So let's say that I want to copy the pixels from the neighboring chair and paste it over this chair. Well, that's pretty easy. I can just do a very easy rectangular marquee to select it. I can do a copy and then a paste. So edit. Nope. So this is where you have to be careful to select the correct layer. Select the background layer, copy it, paste it. And what this will do, you won't see much of a change, but there is, in fact, a new layer that only has these pixels. Now what I can try to do is use the Move tool that exists very far in the upper left-hand corner of the Tools menu to move that layer over and just sort of approximate where it is going to be. So now you can see that we have a little bit of work to do to correct it, but already we've done, like I said, most of the job of removing the cat. You can see there's some evidence here. It doesn't line up exactly. The lighting isn't perfect. But we can use a variety of tools like the free transform tool. So under edit, there's a free transform tool. Using this, you can actually do a lot of modifications to a layer, such as rotating it slightly, making it bigger, taller, shorter. It doesn't matter. You can do a lot of modifications to it here. And so I'll just try to do a rough estimate of how I think this might look. All right, I'll do that for now, and then I might do another modification using transform, like skew, to actually try to shear the image just ever so slightly. So it's not going to look perfect, but what did you expect? It's a live demo. All right, so there, we've already removed the offender mostly from the image. But you can see there's a slight imperfection. There seems to be, it almost looks like the chair has a pimple or something right here, and that has been replicated in the neighboring pixels. And so we could remove that by, again, copying and pasting other pixels on top of it or repeating this process. We would then also have to probably use an adjustment layer and a mask to try to change the brightness of this slightly. So we might just create an adjustment layer that only applies to this new layer of ours with these pixels and just selectively make regions brighter, like this corner here. Let's see. Yeah, probably just, I mean, this is the major part, this corner here and this corner over here. Just get it to match a little bit more. Then we will have a pretty good approximation of this. Now, to a trained eye, they'll be able to tell that you've removed them, but that's okay.
Sorry, just one more question.
Sure.
This is just, I have hours of issues with you. So the layer number two, which is the square.
This layer, yep.
Mm-hmm. Just sort of select that over and over and over again.
Okay, so if you want to just select this over and over and over again, I recommend a couple of things. First is an organizational tool. So down here along with in the layers palette, we have right next to the create a new layer button, a folders button. Now I recommend that if you're going to make a lot of modifications to one specific layer, you create a folder for that layer. It calls it a group, and then you just group all of these layers that modify that one together. It'll just make it a lot easier for you if you have lots of these smaller layers that have adjustments applied to them. You can then collapse the group and do a variety of organizational things. Now, this doesn't affect the behavior of any of this stuff. It just affects the organization. So just by putting it in a group doesn't make what you're asking any easier. So we still have to do some work to get an adjustment layer to apply only to this one specific layer. But one of the easiest ways that we can do that is to right-click it. And you'll notice that one of the options that we have is select pixels. And what this does for us automatically is selects the pixels that exist in that layer as a whole. So right now I have mostly rectangular. I've done some skews to it so you can see that it's not perfectly rectangular shaped. But if this layer also had some pixels over here and some pixels over here, those would also be selected. Now I could create a new adjustment mask. So let's say I want to do what I was talking about before, new adjustment layer. I want to make it a little bit brighter. Just try to match the corners a little bit. All right, that looks good. Click OK. Now you'll notice that automatically what it has done is select only that region that I had selected before. So now this mask is causing this adjustment layer to only apply to that layer that I had selected. What's bad about this method is that if you move the pixels here in this layer 2, let's say I move it over here, it doesn't actually change the mask as well. So I should probably make this a little bit more obvious. So here you can see the mask. I would also have to move the pixels in the mask as well. Or I could do the same thing, select these pixels, go back to this mask, and just recreate the mask with only those selected pixels. Okay? So be careful with that. Okay, so just very, very quickly, the other method that you can use to remove backgrounds, remove people, is this this clone tool. So I will selectively unhide that group. Now this clone stamp tool does a similar thing in that it copies pixels from one region of a photo to another region, but it does it a bit differently, allows you a more careful selection of the pixels that are copied. So this tool is a two-step process. First, you have to tell Photoshop where to get the pixels from. Then you have to tell Photoshop where to put these pixels as the final result. So the first step, you hold down that Alt key and you notice that the mouse will change to a crosshair style cursor. When you hold down the Alt key, you click on a region of the image that you're going to copy from. So right now I just approximated kind of the center of this chair, and then now I will be able to click and copy. So all I'm doing is just holding down my mouse button and dragging along this general area. And you'll notice that on the right side, there's a crosshair that indicates where the pixels are coming from. And then on the left side is a brush telling me where I'm putting those pixels. Now, this is all well and good, except the problem is that if you are doing this very close to some break in the texture, so let's say down here where the seat has become green, and I'm like, oh, this is going to be perfect, it's actually going to copy that region as well. So you have to be careful to pick a region where it will be able to get all of the pixels that it needs. So being able to pick a portion and then matching it in terms of, you know, its height or its geometry is very, very important for the clone stamp tool. And then this way, arguably, I get a faster or a better result more quickly. The problem with the clone stamp tool is that it is a destructive edit. I have actually modified the pixels in this lowest layer. So now the only way I can get them back is just to do an undo. The fix to this would be to just duplicate this layer and then perform that modification, then I would maintain the original, but that's sort of a hack. It's not the best way to do it. So the clone stamp tool, it's nice because it's arguably faster, but it's not nice because it's a destructive edit. Okay, any questions so far? Yes?
You're dreading when I raise my hand. Right?
I
just to clarify what we were talking about earlier, trying to apply an adjustment layer to just one layer.
Yes.
So, for example, you know, you've taken your cat and you've put it on all these other chairs in different layers, and now you want to make one of them red, one of them green, and one of them blue.
Mm-hmm.
Grouping in a folder like that does not actually mean that all of the layers within that folder only apply to the main layer in that folder or anything useful like that. It's just an organizational tool?
That's correct. So the organizing these layers into folders, it doesn't imply any relationship between the layers other than whatever abstract relationship you are applying by name only. So by putting these two layers together into this group, I'm just saying for my own purposes that these two layers belong together. But I'm not telling Photoshop any sort of relationship between the pixels of the two layers, between the mask of one layer, between the pixels of the other. There's no sort of functional relationship other than this organization, though arguably one of the most useful aspects of this is that you can click on the eyeball to show or hide the entire group, which can be useful if you want to do it that way. But otherwise, there might be a way, but there's none that I know of to be able to link these together through a group. I believe you can link layers together using some sort of a link mechanism. Looks like
there is a link that I found. It does, like when you grab one with the move tool and move it, all of the layers will move with it, so you won't end up with your mask someplace completely other than where you just moved the image to.
Right.
So I know how to do that, but the only way that I've found to, you know, make one cat red, one cat blue, is to actually change the image itself, the human saturation of the image itself, instead of doing it in an effects layer, which would, of course, be the preferable way to do it because it's not destructive. But I haven't discovered how you apply an adjustment layer to only one layer, if you see what I'm saying.
Right. So yes. So the effects portion of a layer, that's something different. That doesn't actually, it's what it sounds like. Let's see. It allows us to apply effects to it, and it's not always the most useful thing unless we want something like a glow or a shadow or something like that.
That's not actually.
So.
Photoshop calls things similar things.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Right.
I'm just saying, I don't know.
Right. Yeah. So you can. So this is what I was. Yes. So this is what I was talking about before. So if you want to apply an adjustment only to a specific layer, non-destructively. So destructively, you can do it by selecting a layer and then just performing whatever modifications you want through the image adjustments menu. However, you can non-destructively modify that layer as well through the use of masks. And so Photoshop luckily will make this somewhat easy for us if we select the pixels that we want masked. So we can do this several ways. We can use one of the selection tools in the toolbar, or we can right-click a layer that we want to apply this edit to. We can select its pixels, and then as soon as we perform, or as soon as we create a new adjustment layer, because this adjustment layer is also going to create an associated mask, Photoshop will automatically recognize that I have a selection, and it will create the mask automatically based on that selection. So right now I have the pixels from layer 2 selected, which is right here. It's not visible right now. The whole group is hidden, so you don't actually see the pixels, but the pixels are selected. Now I can change whatever values I want by doing something crazy with the levels, for example. And you'll notice that automatically the mask has been applied. So now when I view this group as a whole, I want to get rid of this one. Oops. We can see that now the modifications that I've made apply only to this specific layer and not to the layer underneath. So I'm non-destructively modifying layer 2 and not the layers above or beneath it. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just picturing taking 3 hours after, I've got all the, I've got a layer to adjust the hue, and then I've got a layer to adjust the brightness, mm-hmm. All for this one little section of pixels, like the Mona Lisa's hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realize, my mask isn't quite right. I just want to take out a little more around this finger.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have to go and take out that little bit on 4 different masks in 4 different layers by hand instead of just being able to take it out once.
Right, so I understand that if you have, so just to reiterate, if you have multiple layers, you've created the mask very painstakingly the same in each, you want to modify them all, there's no easy way to do it. So
actually, that's not true, because then you can
right, exactly. Right. Yeah, you can just view the mask, you can copy and paste it. And I was about to say there might be an easier way, there might be a way to somehow link masks together. Frankly, I have no idea. If I think that might be possible, I just don't know what the steps would be to do that. Yeah, copy and paste, just copy all these pixels and paste it, and it'll make your life a lot easier from one mask to another. It's a question? Lightroom?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't really use Lightroom. What is it supposed to let us do?
The answer is yes. Lightroom allows me to do that.
To do what?
To link masks together so that when you, if you change something and then want to change something else, you can.
So Lightroom will link masks. Okay, cool. So there must be, I imagine that there must be a way to do it in Photoshop. But I do a brain dump of Photoshop to you guys, and I tell you pretty much, it makes me sound really smart, but trust me, at the end of the day, I've told you everything I know about Photoshop. So I'm telling you what I know, and I'm sure if there's a way to do it in Lightroom, I imagine there's a way to do it in Photoshop. Tonight I'll be, feverishly trying to figure out how to do that so that next year I don't look so stupid when I'm trying to answer these questions, but I don't have an answer for you right now. So maybe after, when we take a break, maybe I'll just try to quickly Google something and see if we can get a better answer.
I think there's a way to do a link if it sort of hovers between two layers. I think there would be a little pop-up. I've done it a long time ago.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. I know that there's a way that you can, there's like a chain of some kind that lets you chain the two together.
Yeah.
All right, let's do this the easy way. Let's take a 5-minute break. And in 5 minutes, I will seem amazingly smarter. So let's take a quick break. Okay, hello everyone, welcome back. So if you are watching the video, be sure to fast forward to now, because now I will be looking lots. Okay. I have two great methods that I just taught myself how to be able to achieve what you want. So what I mentioned before about how groups are primarily for organization was apparently a bit of a white lie. We can actually modify pixels of the entire group as a whole. And I have to say that the way that these two methods that I'm about to show you are shamefully simple. I should have looked this up a long time ago, but I frankly was just, I felt like it was too much bother to just go searching about for how to accomplish this, and I just copy and pasted masks from one layer to another. Guess what I will not be doing from now on. Okay, so I have a group, and within this group, I have a hue and saturation layer, a levels layer, and that that set of pixels that I had created before. So I just copied a rectangular box of pixels, pasted them into a layer, and I put them all into a group. And so if I just show this group, you can see not only the set of pixels here, but also those adjustment layers that are working their magic on my photo, making it look tremendously better. Now, here is the part where things get ridiculously simple. So once you have a group, you can add a mask to that group. So there's a button here right next to this button. This button with a square and a little circle inside of it is Add a Layer Mask. You can either select that, or you can go up to Layer and Add a Layer Mask. So we'll do, like, say, Hide All. And now you will notice that a mask is applied to the group as a whole. So all of the layers within that group, all of the adjustment layers within that group, are bound to this mask as it exists. So I can now modify this mask by selecting the pixels from this layer, going up here, deleting those pixels, and now I can see all of those layers, the adjustment layers and the raw pixels themselves, are impacted by this one mask. Okay? So this is an easy way of being able to link a mask to one group, and then that mask will be applied to all of the layers held within that group. So now if you have number of adjustment layers, you can modify, or you can add more adjustment layers, and you will only have to modify one mask for each of those. Now there's a different way that we can do this as well. Let's say that, and I'll create a new selection here. So I'll just select this bit here, and I will create a new layer via copy. Let's see. Okay, yeah. So now I create a mask on this layer. So new layer. Oops. New layer mask, and I will do a reveal all. And again, I will just do that same trick that I did before, where I selected the pixels, and I will actually, let's see. All right, so now I have the one layer that only has this set of pixels that are shown based on a layer mask. Now what I can do is apply layers on top of it, and if we create, I'll just create as an example a new adjustment layer where I do something crazy to the color balance just to demonstrate. All right, so that looks, that looks pretty crazy. Now, you'll notice that I have done what we've seen up until now. I just have a typical adjustment layer with a mask that I can modify. But if I change this layer to something called a clipping layer, so if I click on Create a Clipping Mask, this basically does the inverse of what we've seen before. So notice that now this adjustment layer has an arrow that points down to the layer underneath it. And what this says is that this layer will only be applicable to all of the visible pixels in the layer below it. So now I've applied a mask to this layer, and this clipping layer only applies to those pixels that are within this layer that's right here. Okay, so I think using this group method is a little bit more intuitive, but this is a different way of achieving a pretty similar thing. Okay? Great. Now, no more hard questions because there's no more breaks. So, no, but that was very good. Thanks for bringing that up. Now we all know how to be able to do this. Okay. Any other questions on masking and layers? I do want to move on. We do have other things to talk about today. Okay. Now, if I can just remember what those other things are. Okay, so one of the aspects of digital photography that has been really big as of late is this modification of images into something called high dynamic range. And many of you are probably familiar with high dynamic range images, but they can be used to really create some really neat looking images. So this image, for example, it looks almost cartoon-like, but it is actually an image that has been so heavily modified with this high dynamic range technique that actually makes all of the colors look fake, look false. And I don't remember all of the details behind this image, but there are apparently, I think, literally dozens of images that are basically copied or pasted on top of one another to be able to create this composite image with all of the variants and colors and really cartoonish looking colors that exist here. And in fact, some of the regions I think look particularly cartoonish, such as this area down here, but the clouds, for example, look, I think, the most photographic-like, which sort of indicates or at least sort of hints to the power behind high dynamic range. And at least in this case, it also hints at the original source material that created this final image. Now, that doesn't mean that high dynamic range images can always go well. And I feel kind of bad picking on this one image because it is from a photographer who apparently is also from El Paso. And my girlfriend stumbled upon this and sent it to me, and she's like, OMG, look, it's so good. And I looked at it, and I'm like, why? And there's a couple of things about this image that really bother me. So first of all, there's a blatant moon right here that is sort of silly. But the biggest problem is that there's huge areas of overexposure that have no details. But this is the important part. That part is okay, but what's important is that this violates something called tonal hierarchy. Because this area is the sky, it should be brighter than the sand below it, but it's not. It is darker. If you notice, it appears darker than the sand. So it's this sort of, there's this graduated neutral density filter of sorts that has been applied to this image, where now down here, this is properly exposed. And as we go up, we're trying to correct for overexposure by overcompensating for the brightness. And so some people really enjoy this image. I mean, it's neat because it's definitely a surreal image. It's definitely off-world. But I think that fixing some of these problems would be able to, we'd be able to make this image even more successful. We would be able to maybe recover some of the details that were lost in these highlights, for example. And I think violating this tonal hierarchy is a risk that comes when we're trying to do some high dynamic range photos. And so in this case, this isn't necessarily a high dynamic range photo, but it illustrates this idea of tonal hierarchy, where there are pixels that we expect to be brighter, and they should be brighter than pixels that are elsewhere within the scene. And when we create a high dynamic range photo, what we are trying to do is use a series of bracketed exposures. So one exposure that is somewhat dark, but we see all of the details of the very bright objects very well. Then another exposure that's a little bit brighter, and we're starting to get some of the details of the darker regions, and then brighter and get the shadow regions, and brighter and get the very dark regions of the image. Then we can combine all of these images into one image so that we remove the problems that we get with very low dynamic range cameras. So we have a very high dynamic range scene. We need to try to replicate that. We could try to compress the dynamic range physically by altering light, by using fill flash, for example, or by using some selectively placed shadows to remove some very harsh lights. Or we could try to do this in software as well, by taking multiple exposures and combining them later in, say, Photoshop or some other software that allows us to reconstruct an image based on what we have seen or how we have perceived that scene to begin with. So in order for us to be able to create a new high dynamic range image in Photoshop, luckily the tools several years ago for doing this were very, very elementary. There were two basic. It made this accomplishing this task very, very difficult. Luckily, these tools have matured quite a bit. And there's even beyond Photoshop, with its merged HDR function found in the Automate section of the File menu, there's entire suites of software that are devoted to this style of photography. And if you really enjoy the high dynamic range look, because there is sort of an associated look to it, then you might consider moving beyond Photoshop and looking into some of these third-party software tools that exist. But luckily, we get, along with Photoshop, the ability to merge several exposures into one and create a high dynamic range scene. Now, in order for us to do this, we have to understand something about what Photoshop is doing to create one high dynamic range file. Now, you'll notice that when I select the Merge to HDR menu item, it brings up this window that allows me to add multiple exposures into one. So I have, a not very good demo from the spring where I had, basically I had taken a picture of the lecture hall and intentionally shown, you know, the very wide dynamic range of the hall. So if we turned off all the lights and just took a photo of the hall, we would get this problem where the chairs, for example, are very, very dark. We lose all the details there. But also the screen, the projector screen, is very, very bright. So the dynamic range in this scene is very, very high for this camera. We are unable to capture all of the bits, all of the photons that exist in this scene with just one exposure. So by varying the exposure and by going from one exposure to the next, then we can try to capture all the details across numerous exposures. So this is just a different way of saying that we bracketed this exposure. We took one photo of a scene where multiple different exposures took place. And so one of the things that we need then in order for this to work is a good stable tripod and not move the camera between any of these exposures. Anything that interferes within the scene, so let's say somebody walked in the scene, let's say that the image in the projector had changed, this would destroy the work that we are trying to do. So this is a very specific solution to what we are to achieving a goal, but it is a solution that has become very, very popular online, and that is why we are talking about it today. So what Photoshop attempts to do is you point it to all of these files that have various exposures of a scene that you want to compress into a high dynamic range photo, and it analyzes the data within them. So remember that each image has associated with it some metadata called the EXIF data. This EXIF data can tell Photoshop what the exposure was of a particular scene. So this one, for example, might be like ISO 100 at f8 at maybe half a second or something like that. And then this brighter image might be ISO 100 at f8 at maybe 1 second, so a stop away. So Photoshop will read that metadata when it is reading one of these images, and it will take it into account. And what it will do is it will apply a raw brightness level to every pixel in every image. So it will say, okay, well, I know that this scene was exposed at ISO 100, f8, and what did I say, 1 second. So that must mean that this has a brightness level of, you know, this many lumens, and this has a brightness level of this many. And so it actually will determine the raw brightness of every pixel within a scene. And it will do this for all of the images that you try to combine. Now, if you recall, when we're talking about a typical JPEG, so a typical JPEG that might have, say, 10 stops of dynamic range, or maybe even a little bit more, do you happen to know how many different values we'd have to try to represent those 10 bits? So let's say we had a 10-bit analog to digital converter. That means that we're going to have 10 bits worth of information for all of the dynamic range. So in the end, this means that we get about 1,000 different discrete values for each of, for all of the information that exists within one photo. So I'm just talking about one photo. Now imagine that we have more. Let's say we have 12 bits of dynamic range that's possible. This means that we have to times, we have to multiply 1,000 by 2. So it goes from 1,000 times 2 to 2,000 times 2 again is 4,000. So now we've just gone up by 2 bits and we have 4 times as much data within it. Now when we're dealing with all of these different exposures, we can go across quite a large dynamic range very, very quickly because we're varying the dynamic range very, very quickly. And if Photoshop is applying a raw brightness value to every pixel in every image, this means that we could have a file that has even more bits than what we're used to. And in fact, Photoshop uses 32 bits of information to store all of this raw brightness information in an HDR file. Now, we're used to seeing 8-bit files, which that's not anything too surprising. We might have even worked with 16-bit files when you're trying to squeeze the most out of your image when you're after you've processed the raw file, but we've not yet seen 32-bit files. And 32 bits of information is a lot of data. It is a lot. It's not twice as much data as 16 bits, remember. It's twice as much times twice as much times twice as much times twice as much, so on and so forth, 16 times. So it is a lot more data that we have to work with. And as a result, when we actually create a high dynamic range photo within Photoshop, we create an image that we just can't do very much with yet. So let's see, I'll just select all of these. And you know what I should have done? Because I know this is going to take forever. I should have had this start processing because it's going to process and it's going to take forever, this poor little thing. Okay, so just quickly, if your photo moves even the slightest amount, a couple of pixels or so, you should check this attempt to automatically align source images. This will try to align each of the photos with each other so you have a perfectly straight end result. I happen to know that I or somebody kicked the tripod when I was taking this series of photos, so the pixels vary slightly, and so we have to check this. And unfortunately, checking this also means, oh, you see, I'm doing it again. I should just do it. Checking that also means that it is going to take a bit longer to process than what we had seen before. And so what Photoshop does while it's processing this, as you can see, is that it opens each of these files, and I fed it the raw file, not just the JPEG, but the raw file, because then it's going to get the raw pieces of information, the raw information off of the sensor, and be able to make a better determination of the brightness of every pixel. Therefore, I'll most likely be able to get a higher quality version of the end result. Okay, so once it processes all of these files, it will combine them, it will align them, and it will combine them into one image. And from there, I will have a large 32-bit image that I can manipulate. So because I have this image that has 32 bits of information, and again, this will be a linear, if you recall when we were talking about raw files, we said that the information contained within them was a linear information, a linear change in the brightness values within it. And we had to apply something to be able to actually see that properly. Do you remember what that something was? Yeah, tone curve. So again, we have to apply a tone curve to this 32-bit file to compress all of these values into something that we will be able to see. And that will be the next major set of selection that we get to make in Photoshop. And there's a couple of different options that it's going to give us. But the most important one is something called local adaptation, and that is the one that we as photographers will most likely want to use. There's some other ones that also allow us to define, here we go. So we're aligning selected layers based on content. So anyway, when it gives us this selection, we will be able to select some other ones, some other options as well, such as being able to apply a raw tone curve and some other stuff. That's pretty advanced. But I think to start out, using local adaptation is a pretty good way to go. And the way that Photoshop will actually attempt to solve this problem of having way too much dynamic range and trying to display it on not only a screen that doesn't have very high dynamic range, but also storing it in, say, an 8-bit file, which also cannot have, by definition, a very wide dynamic range, it's going to have to try to locally increase the contrast between various things. So imagine if you have, I don't know, 20 stops, or well, that's too many, but maybe 15 stops of information that you're trying to compress into one image, what happens to the contrast? So this is all sort of assignment three review. Let's say we're compressing the dynamic range, what happens to the contrast of the image? Right, it decreases. So we get a lower amount of contrast in the overall image because we're trying to squeeze so much dynamic range into the image. So the way that we can combat this is to use something called local contrast enhancement. And so, it sounds all fancy, but that's just basically what it is. It just applies enhanced contrast to local edges, to specific edges that might exist throughout the scene. And to our eyes, because we see contrast, our eyes are actually contrast detectors. We detect contrast in edges, and that's how we have visual acuity for a great many things. And by applying this contrast enhancement to edges only, not just to not to the image as a whole, because then we wouldn't have enough dynamic range to actually call it a high dynamic range photo. But if we are able to apply an enhanced amount of contrast to just the edges, our eyes will be fooled into thinking that we have a much greater, not only dynamic range, but a much higher contrast as well. And this is the reason, that these high dynamic range images can look so strange or look so fake, is when people overdo this local contrast enhancement, they can really enhance the colors more than how we would perceive the scene, and this could be a bad thing. Okay, I'm running out of stuff to say here, so this thing better hurry up. Let's see. Well, how was your weekend?
I have a quick question.
Oh, good. Yes. You saved me. How many images do you typically need to create a high dynamic range photo? It really varies. I think you need probably at least 3. So you might, a typical high dynamic range photo might start at a bracketed exposure of 3 shots, each one about a stop apart. However, you will have to adjust the number of photos based on the dynamic range that you're trying to compress. If you have something that's much higher than that, like if you review your 3 images and you see that in your darkest image you still have highlights that are overexposed, and in your brightest image you still have shadows that are underexposed, then you might have to go even farther. And using even more images, so even if you have this sort of 3 or 2 stops of dynamic range latitude that you're trying to do, and you create more images within those stops, so let's say you take 5 images and you space them apart at half a stop each, generally you will have more options available to you in the high dynamic range creation process, because then you will be able to maybe stylize it a bit more. So, but just a sort of a default, typical high dynamic range photo would be 3 shots. I'm probably overdoing it a bit here. I think I selected, I don't know, like a dozen or something. That's probably way too many for this particular application, and would definitely make this process a little bit faster. But frankly, high dynamic range photography, I think, I don't use very much myself. I think a lot of people really enjoy using it, and I like looking at high dynamic range photos that are stylized very well. It's just not something that I do myself. So this is very much meant to be an introduction to to being able to use high dynamic range photos, and then from here you'll have to sort of experiment and go on your own to continue with your high dynamic range learning process. Okay, any other questions? Come on. Help me out here. Yes.
Shots that were 3 stops.
You could So yes, you could increase the change in exposure. So you could go two stops instead of one. However, the tools that exist for high dynamic range may not be able to gather as accurately the raw brightness information from the raw file. It may be skewed some way. So the more photos you feed it, the more accurate of a picture it will be able to generate in as it processes the file. So two stops, I think, is pushing it. I think in general, people recommend one stop when you're going with a high dynamic range photo. Woohoo! Okay. Now you'll notice that it's sickeningly bad. There's a reason for this. Now you'll notice, and I'll get back to that in just a second. Let's see. You'll notice that along the left side here, what I have are all of the images that it used to create this end result. And you'll notice that along these images, it actually tells me the exposure steps between them. So I actually used one stop of exposure change between each of these photos to combine them all. So I'll accept this one, which apparently is only a third of a stop away from the brightest, or the near brightest photo. Now, this result that you see here is most likely because one or more of these images is off from the rest. And so we could try to find those offending images and remove them. And there's just one in particular that was giving us the most trouble. And just by removing that one, we now see something that looks a lot better. Now you'll notice that one of the important things that we have to do is actually set a white point. So we have to tell Photoshop what we want to define as pure white in this finished result. And by default, it selects something that's pretty far to the left. It's not actually all that white. And to get a true high dynamic range shot, you might consider moving it over to the right. The end result, of course, is that you're going to darken everything as a whole. So you want to just select something that might look kind of reasonable. So it does look a little bit dark on the display or on the projector, but on screen it looks just fine. So the bit depth, you'll also notice, this is what I was talking about before, where we have a bit depth of 32 bits per channel. This is a lot more than what we had seen before. All right, so response curve, let's see, I'll just leave this stuff the same. Click OK, and it will create a file in a very large 32-bit file. So if I were to actually save this file, it would be absolutely massive. It would be a monster of a file. And generally what you want to do is convert it down from 32 bits down to something less, like 16 or even 8 bits, before you can manipulate it. And in fact, you'll notice that once we have a 32-bit file in Photoshop, there's not a lot of manipulation that we can do anyway. It will be very, very basic. I think the only thing we will be able to do is modifying its exposure. Okay, so here you'll notice along the top of the window, it says RGB/32, indicating to me that this is a 32-bit file. You'll also notice that there's sort of a ghost image here. That's because, like I said before, I bumped the tripod, and so this wasn't perfect. This is what will happen if you don't get if you don't use a tripod when trying to create your high dynamic range photo. And if we just take a look through some of the menus, you'll notice that there's not a lot that I can do. I can adjust some stuff, like the exposure and maybe the saturation and some other stuff, but a lot of these tools are just grayed out. There's just not a lot I can do. So generally what you'll want to do is convert it down to an 8-bit file, and this is where that method that I was telling you about will come into play, and it is from here that you will generally select where that high dynamic range conversion will take place. So just starting out, I recommend local adaptation. And you'll notice that it processes, just in a preview, something that definitely looks compressed. We can see immediately a lot more information than what we saw before. And just to show you again, this is without that local adaptation. This is with the local adaptation. So just as a reminder, this is compressing all of that dynamic range into the limited window that we have for JPEG files. And then it's increasing the contrast locally within edges, for example, to be able to make it look like there still is some contrast available to us. Now, you can actually modify a tone curve and histogram here as you see fit. You maybe want to make it a little bit contrastier. Obviously, then you lose some of the dynamic range if you modify this too much. We will just select the defaults and click OK, and after a little while, it will convert our 32-bit high dynamic range photo down to an 8-bit photo that we will be able to manipulate. And this is in stark contrast to the original exposures that you saw, where if we were able to view these seats, then the screen was completely blown out. There was no detail in it. We just lost all of the color information that was there. So by using high dynamic range, we can try to compress all of this information into one. But we still have to be careful. In this case, it looks like we're not really, well, there's not a lot of obvious, violations of the tonal hierarchy. Like the bright areas of the screen are still brighter than the surrounding areas, but with enough adjustments to these settings that we've seen, you could actually violate this tonal hierarchy and you could make the photo look a little bit more surreal or a little bit more fake than perhaps you originally intended. So this is just one way of creating a high dynamic range photo. You could, of course, do it manually somehow. That might be quite a pain. You can, like I said, download other pieces of software as well that will be able to do maybe even a better job, where you have more control over the high dynamic range photo than what Photoshop gives you. But it's a pretty interesting and it's a pretty fun thing to try with your photographs, and I certainly recommend that you give it a shot if you haven't quite yet. And so, let's see. So, quickly, I did just want to mention one more thing about Photoshop as well, and that is that frequently when we first download an image onto our computer and look at it on screen, we see that it has a certain amount of sharpness, but we perhaps don't have as much sharpness out of an image that we want. And this could be due to, well, for a number of reasons, but primarily the anti-alias filter that exists on top of your Bayer color filter array sensor. Because we have to soften all of the details just a little bit, we sometimes have to try to recover those details from an image. And typically what you would do in this case, oh, I feel sad clicking that don't save button. Spent so long, worked so hard trying to give me that photo. All right, so let's see. So typically what we would do to sharpen an image, is we would apply something called an unsharp mask. And so this uses a similar idea to what I was just talking about increasing local contrast. It uses this idea to increase the local contrast and it makes things look sharper than they are. Now you can overdo this and you will make things look fake if you overdo it too much. Oh my goodness, oh that's right, I modified this to all sorts of craziness. Revert. All right, here we go. Okay, so if you can definitely overdo the sharpening, and if you do that, then you will get these very strange halo effects that can exist. But generally, if you apply a light amount, you will get a reasonable amount of sharpening. Now, when you go, just to do a quick review, you click on Filter, and under Sharpen, you click on Unsharp Mask. And basically what it's doing, you can imagine that it's creating a new layer. It's basically copying this layer into a new one. And then it's making it just ever so blurry. Okay, now this may sound unusual, but bear with me for a second. It blurs the image ever so slightly. And then what it does is it uses this blurry image as a mask for this image here, and it increases the contrast of the blurry areas. What this means is everything that has been blurred is the edge, is an edge of some specific region. And so this is just by using it's counterintuitive, but using a blur, we're able to detect the edges. So that's just sort of how it's working behind the scenes. It's detecting the edges using this unsharp mask by blurring it slightly and applying a mask, and we can then selectively increase the contrast of only the edges. And this is generally a good way to go for photography. Now radius, so there's a variety of settings here, and generally I recommend that a good starting place is something like an amount of 100 or 50 with a radius of about 0.3 and a threshold of 0 is probably fine. And what this means is the amount of sharpening that, or the amount of contrast enhancement that's occurring. If it's too much, you will get these halos that I mentioned before. So now do you see how it looks unusual, looks strange? Because we're adding way too much contrast locally. And now this might even be a relatively good way of seeing what I mean by local contrast. You can see that it is finding edges and only increasing the contrast around those edges. Okay, so you start at about value of 100 or so, and the radius is how much it is actually blurring the original image. And generally, you don't want this to be too much. A radius of about 0.3 pixels will only blur it the end result will only be, a pixel or two around the edges. You don't want it to be too much. If it's too much, then your halos will probably be too big, as you can see here. So if you make the radius too big, the halos will be larger. You won't be doing as much local contrast enhancement as you will global enhancement. So you want to have a relatively small radius. And then a threshold probably does something cool. I don't really mess with this too much. It's really the amount and the radius that I deal with. So then after you've adjusted it, and you will have to adjust these numbers based on your specific photo, based on the resolution, based on the subject, based on how much sharpening you want. It's very, very subjective, but you really do not want to overdo this. Err on the side of giving too little, because if you give it too much, it will look fake, it will look bad, and people will call you out for it, especially online. And you don't want to have a lot of halos. If you submit your photos for discussion boards, you're like, check this out, and people are like, no, this sucks, go away. Okay, anyway, that has not happened to me. I is the opposite. I told people they suck. No, I'm kidding. All right, and with that said, that is Unsharp Mask. This is the last videotaped lecture. I hope to see you all next week when we will be reviewing all of the photos from the past two assignments. We will have a great time. So until then, have a great week.